plan to cool off today, tomorrow, and really Friday. I mean, it's going to be warm out there. We're talking about summer-like heat, so
live. And we are talking very hot temperatures that could, in fact, break record highs.
Thursday, early Thursday morning, it's going to sit right on top of us, and there comes the hot weather.
Record temperatures are expected to hit California beginning tomorrow. It'll cool down a bit this weekend, but this spring heat wave comes just as we're learning that our mega drought is now so severe, it is the driest the Western United States has seen in at least 1,200 years. That's right, the worst since 800 AD. Andrew Schwartz is the lead scientist with UC Berkeley's Sierra Snow Lab up in Donner Pass, and he's part of a group of scientists across the state who recently measured California's snowpack and drought conditions, and what they found was troubling. Welcome to Press Play, Andrew.
Hi, Madeline. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Well, this time of year, the snowpack is usually at its highest after all the winter snow. But what does it look like this year?
Yeah, generally the snowpack at this time of year has the biggest depth and the most what we call snow water equivalent, so the most water within it. And right now, unfortunately, at our April 1st measurement, it was only at about 38% of what we would expect for average.
Wow, 38%. So what does that mean in terms of how much water we have for the rest of the year?
Well, it's a clear signal that we're going to be in another drought year, unfortunately, and that our conservation of water really needs to ramp up. And further, what's more concerning, I think, in my personal opinion, as somebody who lives up around Lake Tahoe region, is that that means that our melt is also about a month ahead of schedule. And so that means that we have an extra month of drying of our forests and underbrush before peak fire season occurs.
What does it look like where you are? You live up in the Donner Pass, I understand.
Yeah, so the lab here is right at the top of Donner Pass, just on the southwest side of Boreal Ski Resort, for those of us that know the area. But it looks a deceptively calm. There is still a pretty widespread white blanket of snow on the ground, but it is shrinking rapidly. You know, ordinarily at this time of year, we'd be looking at probably still having about 6 feet, 7 feet of snow on the ground. And in most spots right now, we only have about a foot and a half to 2 feet. So, you know, if you're driving past, it might look deceptively like there's plenty of snow, but we're pretty far underneath what we would hope for right now.
Well, last July, the governor urged Californians to reduce water use by at least 15%. So that was a voluntary reduction, not a mandate. But the state said this week that nobody did that. The decrease was less than 1%. So do you think mandatory restrictions are on the way?
I really don't see any way around mandatory restrictions right now, to be honest. The drought that we're in and the lack of precipitation that we see in the forecast means that we're not likely to come out of it soon. And you know, those mandatory restrictions, while an absolute pain to deal with, will definitely save us a future headache. One of the areas that I came from when I was doing my PhD in Australia is Brisbane, and we had very similar drought conditions out there, and we ended up with many, many towns needing to have drinking water, shower water trucked in because all their reservoirs had dried, and we need to do everything that we can with our restrictions to ensure that that does not happen on a large scale here in California.
Is Australia a window into our future?
I think in some regards, it's a good comparison to the present. I think Australia is often seen as this land of extremes between the fire and the drought, but also, of course, recent flooding. And many of those are also very mirrored here in California. But I think in terms of what they called the Millennium Drought in Australia that lasted for, I think it was 17 years total, you know, that could very well be in the cards for California and could be in our future. And even if it's not, we need to prepare like it is so that in a best-case scenario, we just wind up with an abundance of water. And in a worst-case scenario, we've conserved enough to help us move forward.
Well, I guess I'm wondering if we can conserve enough. Will there ever be enough rain again as there once was?
I guess realistically, you know, it's a compound problem, right? At one point in time, there was enough rain, but between climate change and, of course, our always expanding population, we're going to have to start looking in other directions. And whether that's desalination or pipelines, whatever it is, we need to really start looking at it and acting on it now. And for the meantime, conservation may not be enough for the entire future, but it may help hold us over until we have some better infrastructure in place and better models and research that we can do to help us into the future with our water.
A lot of our water here in California goes to agriculture. Can you envision a scenario in which we no longer become an agriculture-heavy state, that it just becomes, it's just too costly water-wise to keep growing all of these crops?
This is one of those conversations that's going to be very difficult, but a very important one to have. There has to be priority set aside, and there has to be a neutral agency or group of people to do that. And I think one of the first places that we do have to look is the agricultural sector. How much is being wasted versus how much is actually needed? You know, that's not to say that agriculture shouldn't get any water, or maybe even that it should be reduced, but there does need to be a very close examination of how much water is being used by all sectors and how we can do a better job of proportioning it and sending it out to the people that need it the most.
And here in Southern California, we get a lot of our water from the Colorado River. That, too, is drying up. So where do you see the future in terms of Southern California's water?
That's a really challenging aspect. I think right now, you know, Colorado has actually had a much better snowpack year than we have had here in California. So there's a little bit of hope for at least an improved flow of the Colorado River this summer. But with that being said, the Colorado River isn't going to sustain Southern California much further into the future. It's become very clear as well that with all the different Western water law, every drop of water is claimed 8 or 9 different times. And so there's kind of this muddy mess of course, this very rapidly shrinking water supply and then all of the hands grabbing at it. So unfortunately, we will have to start implementing new water techniques and management in order to get the water that used to be supplied so adequately by the Colorado River.
So that, as you mentioned earlier, includes desal plants, which take a long time to build, and they're very costly.
They are very costly, and they do take a long time to build. You know, I think, though, the technology has come a long way. And there has been some very successful implementation, again, in Australia, where they do deal with these types of weather whiplash extremes. A lot of the cities around Australia run their plants in a background state, so they're not costly to get started if they sit empty for a while. But there is another question with those, and that's how do you dispose of all the salt that's being removed? And that's a heavy environmental burden that we need to consider as well. But at this point, looking forward, at least in my experience, you know, desal is probably looking like one of the better options at this point.
Andrew Schwartz, lead scientist and station manager at UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you again, Madeline.
Coming up, some good news. The baseball season begins. The Dodgers look really, really strong. And we'll check in with Evan Kleiman about hot pot cuisine. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lentil?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
All right. It is time to welcome in Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. And today we are going to talk about hot pots. Hi, Evan.
Hello.
What's a hot pot?
A hot pot is a communal dining experience over a pot of boiling broth of some kind, into which vegetables and meats are cooked and eaten, often with a dipping sauce.
So like shabu-shabu.
Like shabu-shabu is one kind. Pretty much every Asian country has a specialty hot pot. Shabu-shabu is the Japanese version, and there are many, many others.
Which I've learned literally means swish, swish. So I guess you're swishing your item in the water, in the broth.
Yeah, I love that. It sounds like what it does.
Okay, so I guess it seems a little intimidating to do this in the house, to have a hot pot yourself. Is it?
Well, I mean, you know, there's no dearth of hot pot restaurants here in LA. And I, of course, have given you a few, quite a few closed over the pandemic. So if you're a person who has been used to going to one over and over again, but you haven't in the last few months, I definitely recommend checking to make sure they are still around. It's not hard at all. I mean, you can have the broth heated in front of you, either inside a rice cooker, or you can use your Instapot to do it if you don't have a tabletop burner and a pot, which is just what I do. And you can choose from one of many, many, many broths, from a miso broth to a more kind of sweet sukiyaki style broth to the blisteringly hot and numbing Sichuan broths. And you can either buy a base or you can start from scratch. And we're so lucky here because in our Asian markets, there are always a lot of different meats that have been really thinly sliced. So you don't even have to worry about having the technique to slice up your meat. You can just go to the Asian store and stock up. And then you boil the broth and you start cooking.
With your friends or family sitting around and cooking themselves. Like, you don't have to cook it yourself, which is the brilliance of it.
Yeah. I mean, people who are more confident and have done it before or are generally more aggressive will start putting things in the pots. I kind of like to put the more rooty vegetables in first because they take a little while to cook. And maybe I'll put in some mushrooms like enoki to add a little flavor to the broth. But you always want to keep in mind that most of these items that you're going to put in don't take a long time to cook. So you want to fish them out while they still have some integrity. And then you just start adding your meats. And it's said often that if you dip 8 times, your meat is done. And then you can have it with maybe a little sesame paste dipping sauce or maybe a soy and vinegar and chili crisp forward dipping sauce. I have given you several links to both get everything you need to create one at home and then also, of course, hot pot restaurants if you just want the experience and you don't want to cook at all.
All right. So give us some of those highlights before we go to the website kcrw.com to get your full list.
Well, I think two of my favorites are there's a real OG shabu shabu house called Shabu Shabu House. It's really just the stripped down shabu shabu experience available for dinner only. And then on the other side, there's Shabuya in Koreatown. They have a choice of 5 different soup bases and 9 meats. And most of these places do have a vegetable only option. And then Mizu 212, which of course refers to the boiling point of water, is on the west side. And they do premium proteins and vegetables. But if you want to go out to eat and you don't even want to cook over that pot, then you should go to Boiling Point, which is you have 11 different choices of individual pots that come to you completely cooked. So all you have to do is eat.
Hmm. Okay. I mean, part of the fun of it is cooking it yourself, right?
I think so, too. But if you just want to sort of get a toe into the genre, Boiling Point is a great place to go.
All right. All of this is at kcrw.com. And also, if people sign up for your newsletter, they'll get it in their inbox, right? Is that easy to do?
That is easy to do. KCRW.com/newsletters.
Is that a weekly, your newsletter?
Yes. My newsletter comes out every weekend, either Saturday or Sunday, and it has links to all the segments we did during the week, and then a personal letter from me sort of musing about whatever is bugging me that week. And then, you know, links of what I'm watching, what I'm reading.
Oh, sounds great. Sounds like an expanded version of this very segment.
Yes, definitely.
Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. You can listen Saturday mornings at 11 on the radio, or you can download her podcast and listen whenever you want.
Thanks, Madeline.
Well, speaking of hot pots, the Lakers are simmering in one right now. Did you like that segue? Last night, the Lakers were eliminated from making the playoffs, and the Clippers, they are barely clinging to a spot. There is some good news. Dodgers baseball begins on Friday. They'll be in Colorado to play the Rockies. Joining us to talk about all this is Matt Money Smith, co-host of the Petros and Money Show on KLAC 570 AM. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Madeline. How you doing?
I am doing well, better than the Lakers, I guess. What happened?
Yeah, that's a mess. It's, you know, look, that'll go down as is probably, you know, one of the greatest failures in franchise history, just to have someone who's in the conversation as the greatest player in basketball, in LeBron James, someone in Anthony Davis, who's their 6'11", can play basketball like, you know, like a guard that's 6'3". He's got that sort of skill set. To be his running mate and to come in 11th place in a conference, that's as bad as it gets. You know, they just couldn't stay healthy. But yeah, it's a colossal failure. And unfortunately, I would assume some jobs are going to be lost over this one.
Oh, like whose?
Well, for sure, the head coach, he's going to take the fall. It's not fair to Frank Vogel. He won a championship with him 2 years ago. He just didn't have the players that he needed, but that's the easiest one. The general manager of the Lakers is Rob Pelinka, who was Kobe's agent for a long time and is very close with Jeannie Buss. So I just think there's too much of a personal connection there for Rob to be fired. But really, like, if you're asking me, like, whose fault is it? It's LeBron's fault. It's LeBron and his representatives, his agents who run an agency called Clutch Sports. They're the ones behind the Russell Westbrook trade, which was a complete disaster. They're the ones that put a lot of these players together that just decided they didn't feel like playing defense. And that led to just a miserable season. Injuries, not playing on both sides of the floor. It really was a rough go for Laker fans this year.
So too many guys wanting to be the star. Is that the problem?
Well, I think in terms of, you know, just in basketball, everyone can play defense. There are exceptional defenders, but defense is really about effort and commitment. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, this group of players just didn't have it.
Well, speaking of LeBron, the Laker great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar criticized him for some of his on and off court behavior, including a vulgar dance that he was actually fined for doing. So what do you make of all that?
Well, look, Kareem is arguably the greatest basketball player in the history of the sport. He's an incredibly intelligent person, has always been very thoughtful with his comments. And I think he's an important voice, no question, especially in sports where there are so few of them, people really willing to kind of take a stand and not care what others think of him. But Kareem's always been a curmudgeon. He has not gotten along with anyone since I have covered sports. So it's not surprising to me that he would not be happy with the way LeBron carries himself on social media. LeBron James, just like when you say the name, it's a $1 billion industry. You know, he's the most important client that Nike has. Like I said, Clutch Sports is basically his agency, you know, and they're negotiating over $1 billion worth of contracts. So, you know, it goes back to the Michael Jordan comment, you know, from the late 80s, early 90s, Republicans buy shoes too. And he just didn't, you know, Michael was interested in staying in the toy aisle and did not want to invest himself in those conversations. And LeBron's been very much the same. And I think where LeBron gets himself in trouble is he will take up certain causes, and he has done great things. And I think Kareem said that, you know, he opened a school in Akron to help underprivileged kids. And his first, you know, high school class just graduated last year, and they're all going to college. That's phenomenal. I mean, that you can't underestimate what a great impact that has. But at the same time, you know, when, not to get too deep into it here, but, you know, when you have a general manager of the Houston Rockets at the time, Daryl Morey, just tweeting out, "I stand with Hong Kong, I stand for freedom." And, you know, Nike freaks out and China freaks out because there's billions of dollars of basketball business in that country. No one came to Daryl's defense. No one stood by him. And a lot of people were looking to LeBron saying, "Look, you're the one that likes to take up these causes. Where are you at on China?" And he was dead silent. And I think that's sort of the stuff that Kareem is speaking to of what upsets him about someone who has such a strong presence and can really make a difference with his words.
Really interesting. All right, let's switch to baseball. And the Dodgers manager has predicted that they will go all the way. They'll win the World Series. They haven't played a game yet, as far as I understand.
A little premature, huh?
Them? Yeah.
You know, he was asked a question, and I think, you know, that's what's always tough about these poll quotes, you know, is he didn't just grab the lectern and say, "We're going to win the World Series." You know, he was asked, the question that was asked of him was, "The Dodgers will win the World Series if." So instead of saying, you know, if our pitching stays healthy, if we get production at the bottom of the lineup, you know, Dave just went with the, "We're going to win the World Series. You know, I believe in this team. I believe in this roster. I believe we have, you know, everything that it takes to go all the way, to win our division, to win a few rounds of the playoffs, and ultimately, you know, win a 7-game series against the best team from the American League." So on paper, absolutely they do. But you said it, Madeline, they don't play a game until Friday. So, you know, it's a little premature to be making proclamations like that. Because, look, if you make that statement in March and on April, let's say 20th, when you're 10 or 15 games into the season, and instead of being 10-5, you're 5-10, well, then there's just a lot of pressure.
Not helpful. Okay. Quickly, Tiger Woods, he's trying to play in the Masters in Augusta, and he just had that, well, he had that accident. It wasn't that long ago, that car crash in Rancho Palos Verdes. So can he come back? What do you make of that?
I don't doubt him. You know, in talking to people, you know, around him and him directly, actually, you know, he said, "Look, when I had my back injury, I didn't think I was ever going to play golf again. You know, the doctors told me I probably wasn't going to be able to play competitive golf again." And he fought through that. And by all accounts, that was a nasty surgery and injury that he was dealing with his back and with his neck. So having come back from that, I didn't doubt him. I said, there's no way I'm doubting this guy. He is incredible. He is one of one. And, you know, the Masters is funny. You know, there's a reason why you have a handful of players, the best that have ever played golf, that have won multiple Masters championships. There's just something about that course that it fits certain players. And Tiger's one of them. Tiger, just Augusta is great for him. The way the course plays, particularly him being arguably the greatest putter to ever play golf, you know, you really have to be able to putt to win the Masters, and he can do that. It would be incredible. I don't think it's likely, Madeline, that he wins the Masters, but look, he's so good on this course. I think it would be incredible if he made the cut. You know, if he were still playing on Saturday and Sunday, I think that would be just a remarkable achievement this close to that accident. That some, you know, the word was what? He might lose his leg.
Right. I mean, yeah, just good that he's up and standing and walking.
Yeah.
Matt Money Smith, co-host of the Petros and Money Show on KLAC 570. Matt, thank you.
You got it, Madeline.
Coming up, how the Sandy Hook shooting 10 years ago unleashed a war on the truth.
This is really a story in which it's not about the Sandy Hook families or even about victims of mass shootings as much as it is about the spread of misinformation.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, nearly 10 years ago, a gunman entered Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, and killed 20 first graders and 6 instructors. The day after, Robbie Parker, one of the parents, stood in front of a sea of cameras to answer questions. His 6-year-old daughter, Emily, had been shot and killed. And Robbie Parker began his speech with a smile on his face, as if baffled by the spectacle, or maybe he was just nervous. His grief, though, quickly consumed him.
My daughter, Emily, would be one of the first ones to be standing and giving her love and support to all those victims, because that's the type of person that she is. Not because of any parenting that my wife and I could have done, but because those are the gifts that were given to her by her Heavenly Father.
At the time, Robbie Parker didn't realize he was the first family member to speak publicly about his loss that day. And he could not have known how that initial smile at that news conference would be mercilessly used against him and the other Sandy Hook families by people who didn't believe the children were dead. They believed the shooting was a government plot designed to provide cover to take away their guns. Their megaphone was radio host and InfoWars founder Alex Jones.
The whole thing was fake. I mean, even I couldn't believe it. I knew they jumped on it, used the crisis, hyped it up, but then I did deep research, and my gosh.
That tape was from the PBS Frontline episode about Jones called United States of Conspiracy. Well, with Jones' help, Sandy Hook became the first example of what would become a pattern after mass shootings, and eventually the 2020 election, birthing an online community completely hostile to reality, one that fed off itself despite all evidence to the contrary. That's according to my next guest, New York Times writer Elizabeth Williamson. She has a new book out. It's called Sandy Hook, An American Tragedy and the Battle for Truth. And Elizabeth Williamson joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Madeline. It's good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Well, early on in the book, you vividly describe the media environment the families of the Sandy Hook victims had to navigate just after the shooting. And one parent told interviewers for a research paper, they said, "Our daughter is not just our daughter now. She's one of the children who was murdered at Sandy Hook. It's not that I want that to be forgotten, but that is not her story. That is not her life story. That is only how she died." So talk about how these families' grief and their experience became so public so fast, and how that felt to them.
So I guess the words that I would have to use were those that I learned from Lenny Posner, who is the father of Noah Posner, the youngest Sandy Hook victim. And what he said was, "We felt like spectators to our own tragedy," which, you know, it was such a public event. It was such a wrenching historical shooting that the families quickly felt like they were inundated with attention, and that, you know, they were adrift in this sea of media coverage.
And a lot of that initially was mainstream media coverage, and none of that questioned the reality that these children had been shot and killed, and as well as some of the instructors. However, there was something happening elsewhere. And how quickly did the other side, who didn't believe in this, how quickly did that start to form this conspiracy theory around the Sandy Hook shooting?
Madeline, it was within hours. So on the day of the shooting, there were still details coming out, and Alex Jones, you know, started his 4-hour daily InfoWars radio show by talking about the shooting. And his listeners were saying, "So tell us what this was." And they were kind of prompting him and pushing him to say, "Wasn't this a false flag? You know, an event staged by the government as a pretext to confiscate Americans' firearms." And eventually, that's where he went. And particularly, you know, after he learned what the terrible toll was at Sandy Hook, he could see that denying the shooting, because he does have a pro-gun agenda, denying that the shooting ever happened or that it didn't happen the way the government and the official narrative said it did, was useful to him.
And how is it useful to him?
Generally speaking, Sandy Hook was such a horrific event that it was seen as a watershed in the battle over gun policy by both sides in that fight. So everybody thought that whether they were for or against additional legislation on the gun front, they saw this as a moment in which something would happen. And so what Alex Jones was doing was recognizing that. And because he represented, you know, the far right, you know, pro Second Amendment fringe, he was saying, you know, going a little bit further and not just saying that this will result in some kind of, you know, draconian gun control legislation. He was saying that, you know, this was the whole reason that this shooting even occurred. It never really occurred. It was just something that was meant to prompt this legislation that the Obama administration, in his view, wanted.
Is that truly what he thought at the time? Or was he using this to just drive interest and listeners to his program?
It's a great question, and it's really hard to say. So I think, you know, Josh Owens, who is a former InfoWars employee, answered it best. Whether Alex Jones believes what he says at any given time is almost immaterial when you consider that he has millions of listeners who do believe what he says. And those individuals were mobilized by what he was saying around Sandy Hook.
And so, he was perhaps the most prominent and loudest person pushing this conspiracy, but he wasn't the only one doing it. There was a whole network of people, right? There were other people involved who, maybe some academics at some universities, who lent it an air of credibility. How did all of these people feed into each other?
In a word or two words, social media. The internet and social media in particular made these people accessible to each other. So they found each other, they embroidered their theories around Sandy Hook, they shared them, they built each other up, they praised each other, they, you know, for finding new ripples in the so-called plot, for exposing anomalies in the, you know, mainstream media reporting around Sandy Hook. And then they put it all out there. And they did it in minutes. So, you know, within hours of the shooting itself, these theories had traveled to millions of people.
Why Sandy Hook? There have been mass shootings before. There have been mass shootings since. But why was it that Sandy Hook was the one to raise all of these ideas of conspiracies and false flags and all of that into really galvanize this online conspiracy movement that we now see playing out today in QAnon, January 6th, all of these conspiracies that we are now well aware of?
Yeah. So as we've already talked about, Sandy Hook was a watershed moment in the battle over gun policy in this country. So that was one thing. But second, it was definitely the fact that uptake of social media among Americans in 2012, when the shooting occurred, was exponentially larger than, for example, the Virginia Tech shooting in 2007, which is the worst school shooting in history. So I talked to Lori Haas, whose daughter Emily was wounded at Virginia Tech. She was very active in the gun control movement. She traveled across the country to, you know, appear and speak at different rallies. And I said, have a look at your Facebook account and tell me if anybody accused you of lying or faking this or, being part of some false flag operation. And she looked through and was like, no, actually, no one ever did that. And here's the reason. In 2007, Facebook had 20 million global users. In 2012, when the Sandy Hook shooting occurred, they had more than 1 billion. In 2007, YouTube had 100 million videos viewed a day. In 2012, one video topped 1 billion views. Twitter, it was a year old in 2007 when Virginia Tech happened, 5,000 tweets a day. In 2012, after Sandy Hook, Twitter had 5,000 tweets every second, 400 million a day. And I think that really explains why this hoax gained traction.
Social media. So Lenny goes on social media. He goes on one of these Facebook groups, a Sandy Hook hoaxer Facebook group, and to try to convince the members that he's the real deal, that it really happened, that his son was brutally shot down, mowed down in this classroom. And so what is their reaction to him?
So initially they were expressing their condolences. They were asking some questions. But it was so interesting because as the night wore on, and he talked with them for hours, so he had come prepared with the records of Noah's birth, his death, some school records, and he was saying, I'm here to answer your questions. I'm treating you with respect. I want you to ask me your questions, and I want to convince you that this actually happened and that these 26 people died. And they asked him a few questions, but what they were really trying to do was to trap him in a lie. They were kind of allied among themselves. I described them as a ragtag army, you know, in a Facebook fortress, defending themselves against intrusions of truth. To them, he was a threat. He was a villain in the plot.
So what do researchers say who've been in there and interviewed these people and tried to come up with a theory as to how these hoaxes take root and why people are so committed to them? What is it that drives people to want to believe this over what is objectively the truth, that this mass murder took place?
So a couple things. And I think a lot of times, especially now, because we're so politically polarized, we want to put this down to politics. And in actual fact, what researchers have found is that it is much more someone's psychology and their conspiratorial mindset that kind of predisposes them to latching on to these theories. So when people gather online to share their suspicions, first of all, they start from a place where they're deeply distrustful of the federal government, typically. They distrust all official narratives of major events, whether, you know, especially if they're coming from the mainstream media. So they gather online and they have created a kind of social bond around themselves. And that was what Lenny encountered when he dealt with the Sandy Hook hoax group on Facebook. You know, these are people who have found a new purpose where maybe one was lacking before. This was something where, you know, they could all latch on, they could gather together. They reinforced each other. And suddenly someone who, you know, I talk about a woman named Kelly Watt, who had a cleaning business in Tulsa, Oklahoma, participating in this kind of hoax group around Sandy Hook gave her a different kind of purpose. It made her a researcher. It made her a citizen journalist. It gave her, you know, she contributed a chapter to a book called Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. You know, she had a different kind of identity, and that's why it was so hard to get people to give this up.
Hmm. So it's really their very identity and their social status that is what's at play here. That's very valuable to them. Truth be damned, and so anything can be turned around and looked at and through a different lens, if you will, if that's what's the driving force.
Yeah. So if you are a person who says, hey, I'm just a regular citizen out here on the internet trying to tell you, you know what? I really think it happened. Why don't you take a look at this report and that report and these thousands of pages of documents that were released by the state of Connecticut describing the crime and what exactly happened? You're a threat to them because they get so much psychic income from discussing this and from adhering to this and spreading it, and also real income. One of the most pernicious Sandy Hook hoaxers, Wolfgang Halbig, earned more than $100,000 in donations from people online who just wanted to support his, quote, Sandy Hook truth pursuit.
Yeah. And he's the one who really pursues Lenny and shares his social security number. Lenny's had to move, what, more than a dozen times because people keep sharing his address and doxing him?
Yeah.
So does he regret getting so involved in trying to convince these people to embrace the truth?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, you know, when I met him, he was remarkably prescient because he was saying, you know, I'm like a canary in a coal mine here. This kind of spread of these false narratives is just beginning. And, you know, we see it, you know, from Sandy Hook to Pizzagate to QAnon to Charlottesville to coronavirus to the 2020 election lie. And then the violence that ensued, you know, at the Capitol on January 6th among people who believed the 2020 election lie. He wasn't specific in predicting all of this, but he said, this is really a story in which it's not about the Sandy Hook families or even about victims of mass shootings as much as it is about the spread of misinformation and this certain segment of Americans who really want to embrace alternative narratives, meaning false narratives, around every major event.
But Alex Jones, he is the through line here. So he's in, obviously, he's one of the first super spreaders of this malignant information when it comes to Sandy Hook. But he also hosted Donald Trump on his show early on and had then became an ardent supporter and also was involved in January 6th. Can you describe his involvement there?
Absolutely. So Alex Jones, his audience represents a segment of Americans that Roger Stone, who was a Trump advisor, is maybe still a Trump advisor. He identified Alex Jones's audience as a very valuable constituency for Donald Trump, who was part of a very crowded Republican field looking for a way to gain an edge. And by appearing on Alex Jones's InfoWars show in December of 2015, he found it. And it's interesting because when you listen to that show, you can hear Alex Jones kind of prompting Trump to go a little further, you know, blame the globalists, you know, isn't the country going to hell in a handbasket unless we rescue, you know, so he was really kind of coaching him. But he quickly caught on and he echoed a lot of Alex Jones's themes around Islam, around immigrants, around elite Democrats. So that was a high watermark for Alex Jones. His listeners who had been deeply distrustful of government, maybe standing on the electoral sidelines, became a constituency for Trump.
Alex Jones has been sued by the families, the Sandy Hook families, and he's lost. Has he had to pay them any money?
Not yet. So late last year, because, you know, these suits were filed in mid-2018, four different defamation suits by the Sandy Hook families against Alex Jones. And they, as they made their way through the courts, he has consistently tried to obstruct the process. So he has failed to deliver documents. He hasn't shown up for deposition. So finally, at the end of last year, judges in Texas and in Connecticut, where these suits were filed, ruled him liable by default, meaning that beginning in April, he will appear in jury trials. But the total goal of these trials, and there will be three of them, will be to determine how much Alex Jones has to pay the Sandy Hook families in damages. So it's a resounding victory for them.
Do we know how much money he has and how much money he's made off these, I don't know, conspiracy theories and even just on this particular one?
Yeah. So during the Trump presidency, which was his high watermark, he, you know, these court documents that are very slowly being released in the Sandy Hook cases suggest that in those years, when he was basically a conspiracy advisor to the president, he had revenues of more than $50 million a year.
Oh my gosh. So you can see why he wouldn't be too willing to ease up on the conspiracy theories. It's pretty profitable.
Yeah. And nor is he any too willing to release his business records.
You actually sat down with him and interviewed him at his Austin, Texas compound. Why did he agree to talk to you as a writer for the New York Times? And did he reveal anything to you that you thought was that he hadn't revealed publicly? Did he drop the, I don't know, the pretense at all?
So why he talked to me is a question I've asked myself pretty often since that interview. I remember him saying, you know, you're going to be the hill I die on. I'm going to talk to the New York Times. I'm going to give you my point of view. I'm going to tell you, you know, why I think that I've been unfairly treated in all of this Sandy Hook business. And I'm going to just wait and see if you do an accurate story, which, of course, in his view, an accurate story would be something completely favorable to him. And so he kind of put his view out there. Of course, he blamed the mainstream media. He said, every time you talk about my echoing, you know, or my repeating and inventing these themes, false themes and conspiracy theories around Sandy Hook, you make it worse because you're talking about it. You know, he didn't want to be tarred with it, basically. But, you know, of course, that obviously ignores the fact that he invented these theories and that he was responsible for years of torment of these families. So he didn't really drop the veil. The one moment that I think he actually kind of did was he was trying to menace me the entire time that we were speaking together in this little, you know, freezing cold conference room. He keeps the temperature inside InfoWars headquarters at 60 degrees because he sweats a lot and he doesn't like how he looks on camera when he sweats. So he was, you know, trying to kind of intimidate me, but he was never really leaning over the desk and getting in my face. You know, he was always seeking the corners of the room. He was kind of, you know, bouncing around and yelling at me and, you know, narrowing his eyes and looking at me, but it was from a great distance. And to me, that was kind of a revelation because, you know, I think he can do what he does because he does it from afar. He's addressing an audience. It's a monolith. It's not individual people who are really hurt by what he says.
Hmm. How are the families doing now? It's been almost 10 years since the shooting. These kids would have been, what, 16 years old now?
Yeah, 15, 16.
Preparing to go to college or thinking about college?
Yeah, in the middle of high school. I mean, I never, ever speak for all the families because they, you know, they all have their own interpretations of events. But the families who I spoke with for my book, they have a grace about them that really kind of blows me away, I have to say. I think they spoke with me for the book and they relived, you know, the worst chapter of their lives, not only that day, but everything that came after, which was this terrible secondary trauma, because they actually believe in the system. You know, they're not hopeless. They really think that when people read this book and when they hear their story, that they will be motivated to help them to make some change in the way, you know, social media handles, you know, the spread of these lies online, how, you know, our laws govern the social media companies who, you know, have been protected by legal immunity, actually, from, you know, the consequences of spreading misinformation that really harms people, destroys their reputations, and in many cases, their lives. You know, they believe in the system still, despite everything that's happened to them. They feel like there will be some change. And that if people hear this and they get mad enough, that they will help them.
Well, let's hope so.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for the conversation and thank you for your reporting on this.
It's my pleasure, Madeline. It's great to be with you.
Great to be with you. Elizabeth Williamson, she's a writer for the New York Times. Her new book is called Sandy Hook, An American Tragedy and the Battle for Truth. And that'll do it for us today on Press Play. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter or Instagram at KCRW Press Play and tweet at us. Tell us what you like, what you don't like, what you want to hear more of. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.